Chapter 4.
What kind of a cop can afford a place like this?
Asks Raven, looking around at his penthouse apartment. Maybe I'm on the take, asks Steele.
Not if you're going up against Victor Borodini, you're not,
she said.
You some kind of fed?
Yeah, I'm some kind of fed. Bathroom's through here. You'll probably want to get cleaned up. There's a robe on a hook on the back of the door. You can use that.
Thanks.
At least let me call a doctor to come and have a look at you.
What for? Nothing's broke. I've been through worse. Lots worse.
How old are you?
How old do you want me to be?
Just answer the question.
I'm 22.
Really? You look younger.
Yeah, I know. I told the Johns I am. They like it that way.
You hungry?
No, but I could use a drink. Wash the taste of that bastard's prick out of my mouth.
Steele grimaced at her crudeness. As a cop, he'd met more than his share of ravens. There were a lot of them around. They were different types and different ages, but they all had several things in common. They talked hard and acted tough, and they were cynical beyond belief. They were so accustomed to being used and brutalized that it no longer seemed to matter to them. Sex meant nothing to them. Love? Most of them didn't even know the meaning of the word. Their bodies were things somehow separate from themselves, a commodity to be traded in for survival. Many of them had been used and degraded for so long that it was the only thing they understood. It was as if something deep inside of them had died. Steele understood her all too well. In some respects, cops and hookers had a lot in common. Both lived in worlds where they always saw people at their worst. They had no illusions left about society or the potential cruelty of the human animal. 22. His daughter, Corey, was a mere 7 years younger. And yet, he'd met hookers who were younger even still, though in many ways they were far older than they had any right to be. He went over to the bar. What'll you have?
Got any scotch?
On the rocks?
Neat, in a tall glass.
He poured it. She shrugged off the jacket Ice had given her, took the drink, and headed naked for the bathroom without another word. Steele shook his head and poured himself a drink as well. In the morning, he'd have to see about getting her some clothes. And then what? Then she'd probably go right back to the streets and pick up where she'd left off. She'd find herself another pimp, someone who'd slap her around and treat her like dirt, and turn her out to make some money for him. In a few more years, she'd be all used up, an old woman at 25. What kind of a life was that? And yet, Steele knew that she didn't really think about the future. Girls like Raven rarely did. They'd tell each other lies about what they'd do when they finally got enough money together to get off the streets, out of the life. But it never happened. Their money went to their pimps or up their noses or in their veins. After a while, they simply went on automatic pilot. For them, the future was tomorrow, the next hour, the next minute. Survival in tiny doses, if you could call living that way surviving. It occurred to Steele that in some ways, Raven was even more of a machine than he was. After a while, she came out of the shower wearing his blue terry robe. Her face was still bruised and puffy from the beating she'd taken, but she'd washed the blood and grime off, and had made for some improvement. She was not unattractive. She was even rather pretty, in a hard and feral sort of way. She went over to the bar and helped herself to the bottle of scotch. She brought it over to the couch, along with the glass she'd taken to the bathroom, and plopped down. The robe fell away from her legs as she crossed them. They were good legs, long and shapely, and her bare feet were small and incongruously delicate. She wore a small gold ankle bracelet on her right foot.
Got any smokes?
She said. No!
Shit, I'm dying for a cigarette.
Steele picked up the phone and called security. This is Steele. Anyone down there got any cigarettes? Yeah, cigarettes. Do me a favor and bring some up, will you? Yeah, I appreciate it.
Thanks.
She said.
So your name's Steele, huh?
Yeah. He braced himself for the inevitable questions, but she didn't make the connection. Either that or she hadn't heard of him. Perhaps she didn't watch TV or read the papers. Many of them didn't. They mainlined their entertainment. Steele hadn't noticed any tracks on her arms, but hookers didn't always shoot up in the obvious places. And they didn't always shoot their drugs. She might be a popper or a freak for nose candy. He noticed that she sniffed often, a telltale sign.
My name's Raven.
I know. Slim told me.
How do you know Slim?
I don't really. Ice knows him.
So that was Ice, huh? Geez, for a fed, you sure hang around with some strange people. Word is Borodini's got a big contract out on Ice. He working for you now?
Sort of.
What's your first name?
Donovan.
Why don't you come over here and sit down, Don?
My friends call me Steele, he said. But we aren't exactly friends, are we?
Doesn't have to be that way,
she said. She recrossed her legs in such a manner that the robe fell away and exposed more of them. They were her best feature, and she knew it.
Come on, sit down. Take a load off. Loosen up and have a drink, honey.
Don't call me honey, and don't bother coming on to me. I'm not interested. Nothing personal.
Damaged goods don't turn you on, huh?
It isn't that, said Steele.
Yeah, what then? I'm not your type or what?
I'm just not interested in the sort of relationship that you can buy, said Steele.
Hey, did I say anything about money?
She said, sounding offended.
You got me out of a bad scene. I just thought maybe I'd show some appreciation. That's all.
A simple thank you would suffice. She snorted.
Then what'd you bring me out here for?
You wouldn't go to the hospital. I didn't know what else to do with you. The doorbell rang. Steele went over to answer it. It was one of the security guards with a pack of cigarettes and some matches. Thanks, said Steele. How much do I owe you?
Forget it, Lieutenant, said the guard. I'm trying to cut down anyway.
Appreciate it,
Steele said.
My pleasure, sir.
Steele shut the door and gave the cigarettes to Raven.
Thanks,
she said. She lit one up.
So what's the deal with you and Victor Borodini?
She asked.
I intend to bring him down.
Good luck. When he hears about what you did tonight, he'll be coming after you.
I'm counting on that.
She gave him an appraising look.
You're either very tough or very stupid,
she said.
What you did tonight was crazy. Borodini's going to make a point of finding out who you are and making you pay for it. And you're being a fed is not going to bother him one bit.
I didn't expect it would, said Steele. Look, I'm going to wash up and go to bed. You can use the spare bedroom over there. Help yourself to the bar. If you feel like watching The Idiot Box, go right ahead. Just don't turn it up too loud. And don't mess around with the other screens. They're computer terminals, and there's nothing there that would interest you. Just make yourself comfortable and stay out of trouble. Don't mess with my things. In the morning, I'll see about getting you some clothes. You're going to be hurting later?
I'm no junkie,
she said, bristling at the suggestion.
Tell me the truth, said Steele. If you're going to start hurting, I'll see what I can do to get you fixed. I don't need an addict going through withdrawal on my hands.
I do some blow once in a while, but I ain't hooked,
she said. She held up a bottle of scotch.
This'll do me fine.
Okay, said Steele. Just behave yourself. I'll see you in the morning.
He wasn't really surprised when he heard his bedroom door open softly in the middle of the night. She stood in the doorway for a moment, listening. He made his breathing sound regular and heavy, as if he were asleep. The door closed softly once again, and a short while later, he heard her rummaging around. She was being very quiet, but with his hearing turned up, he could hear everything she did, pinpointing her location as she moved around the apartment. He heard her soft, sharp intake of breath as she opened up the gun cabinet. He got out of bed. She was bent over the lower drawers, where he kept his ammo, magazines, and holster rigs. She'd hear him come in.
Find anything you like, he said.
She got up quickly and spun around. She had put on a set of his black police fatigues and boots. They were large on her, and she had tucked the pant legs into the boots and rolled up the sleeves. She had one of his 9mm in her hand, in her right hand, and a loaded magazine in the other. She started to insert the magazine into the pistol, but he quickly crossed the room and wrenched it out of her hand as she brought it up. She had tucked one of his commando knives into her waistband, and she grabbed for it. He easily caught her wrist as she brought the knife down in a stabbing motion, and careful not to crush her bones. He squeezed. She gasped with pain, and he took the knife out of her hand.
That was really stupid, Steele said. What the hell did you think you were doing? What does it look like?
She said, gritting her teeth with pain and holding her wrist.
How did you expect to get past security? He asked.
I was going to tell them that we did our thing, and you were sending me away.
You don't think they would have called me to check?
I was going to tell them you'd gone to sleep and didn't want to be disturbed. And if they didn't buy it, then I had the gun.
You would have been shot, said Steele. Those men down there aren't your run-of-the-mill billing security. They're trained federal agents. Now put back everything you took and go to bed.
He handed the gun and the knife back to her. She stared at him, stunned.
That's it?
She said with disbelief.
That's all you're going
to
do?
What do you want me to do? Slap you around? I don't get my kicks that way. But I'm only going to tell you once. If you give me any more trouble tonight, I'll just break both your arms. Now put the stuff back and go to bed.
He turned around and went back to his bedroom, leaving her with a knife and a loaded gun in her hands. She stared at his back as he went through the bedroom door and closed it. Then she carefully put everything back exactly where it was. It stripped off the clothes she took and went to the spare bedroom. Still didn't hear another sound out of her all night.
Dev Cooper sat up most of the night in his apartment on Sutton Place, drinking cup after cup of black coffee and staring at the computer screen.
He felt a strange, nervous excitement, like a little boy doing something he knew he shouldn't have been doing. Earlier that day, he'd had lunch with Dr. Philip Gates, the project's chief cybernetics engineer, the man in charge of the team that had programmed Steele's brain. A husky, gruff sort of man,
Gates had at first struck him as being rude and unfriendly, but Dev soon discovered that the impression was erroneous. Most people he'd met so far in New York City struck him that way, and it was merely a result of a different sort of mindset and rhythm from that which Dev had grown accustomed to growing up in the Southwest. People in New York simply moved at a much faster pace. They spoke more quickly and they got right down to business. It was a different tempo from what Dev was used to. It threw him a bit. Since coming to New York, he'd made an effort to adjust and blend in more. He had a new wardrobe now, more in keeping with life in Midtown than his Western clothing was, though he still wore his boots. He wouldn't have felt comfortable in shoes, and he missed wearing his Stetson. It was like a part of him, but here in Midtown it made him look too conspicuous. So he had become something of a hybrid in his well-tailored three-piece suit and Western boots, learning to match his rhythms to those of the people he worked with. He missed New Mexico, and he missed his comfortable little house back in White Rock, the small suburb of Santa Fe where many of the personnel who worked out at the Los Alamos labs lived. He missed the easy pace out there, the relaxed and understated lifestyle, the way the women dressed in Santa Fe, in graceful Spanish skirts and boots, embroidered blouses, concha belts, and Indian jewelry. Compared to them, the women in New York all looked severe and hard and considerably less feminine. But most of all, he missed the country. He missed the red earth of New Mexico, the rolling hills covered with sage, mesquite, and the bright, yellow, booming chamisa. He missed his long walks in Bandelier Canyon, where he could stroll along the wooded riverbanks while hundreds of hermit thrushes fluttered through the branches all around him, and hawks and turkey vultures soared on the thermals overhead, scanning the ground below in search of food. He used to spend hours among the Pueblo ruins dotting the canyon walls, climbing up into the caves and imagining how the primitive tribes there, descendants of the Anasazi, must have lived hundreds of years ago. The entire canyon was the result of a huge volcanic eruption that had spewed out over 50 cubic miles of volcanic ash, enough, if it were concrete, to pave a road from the earth to the sun. He could stand down in that canyon and immerse himself in the tranquility of time. He had once taken a pack trip by horseback out to Chaco Canyon on the grounds of what had been the Navajo reservation before the virus had wiped them all out. There in the middle of one of the most inhospitable areas of the southwestern desert, the Anasazi, the ancient ones, had built their cities out of meticulously laid sandstone brick held together by mud mortar. It was a harsh desert country surrounded by sandstone cliffs. The winter here were long, and there was little rainfall, and the growing seasons were short. Yet the Anasazi had established their culture there in the cities that were, in some ways, as complex as New York. In the year 1000, there may have been as many as 5,000 people living in some 400 settlements in Chaco Canyon, in multi-story stone villages such as Pueblo Bonito, Chetro Ketel, and Hongo Pavi, all tied together by an extensive system of sophisticated roads laid out in straight lines and bordered by masonry walls. Many of the towns were D-shaped, with the interconnected stone buildings running in a semicircle around large central plazas that held suburban kivas, circular pits walled with stone. The roofs supported by rubble-filled masonry columns, the walls set with niches meant for sacrificial offerings. Dev had stood within the ruins of one of the larger kivas, over 45 feet in diameter, and imagined the ancient ones holding their religious ceremonies around the vented fires. He felt somehow connected to the spirits of these people, who the Indians had believed had still inhabited the ruins, which still stood over 1,000 years, their exquisite stonework giving evidence of the culture that had once thrived there. To Dev, those ancient ruins were as compelling as those of Greece and Rome. He felt somehow that some of his ancestors had once lived there before a prolonged drought in the San Juan Basin drove them out, to scatter throughout the Southwest and merge with other tribes. And he wondered now if someday some future archaeologists, perhaps even from another planet, might not puzzle over the ruins of New York City in much the same way as he had wondered about the Anasazi ruins, asking themselves who these people were and what had happened to them. What tragedy had befallen them to make them completely disappear without a trace, leaving behind only the ruins of their architecture to give silent testimony to the greatness they had once achieved. It had almost happened. The bio-war and the brief nuclear exchange that had accompanied it had almost brought an end to modern civilization. The population of the world was now a fraction of what it had once been. Cities where the bombs had fallen were in ruins. Radioactive hotspots could be found throughout the country, as well as in Europe and the Soviet Union. We almost did it to ourselves, thought Dev, but now we've got another chance. If only we don't waste it. Trouble was, it seemed as if humanity had not learned anything from the disaster of the bio-war. Survival was the number one priority as the ravaged cities struggled to rebuild what they had lost. With the imperative of procreation, many people were now having children in their early teens, future workers to staff the overtaxed facilities and farms, to fill out the ranks of the military and police, to help maintain the human race rise up from the ashes of destruction, and take up where it had left off, headed, it often seemed to Dev, on the same course that had almost brought it to annihilation. That was why he had jumped at the chance to work on Project Download. To Dev and many of his former colleagues at Los Alamos, it had seemed like a bright hope for the future. The process of brain-computer interface, the potential for working miracles in human education. And it was in education that the hope for real progress lay. Education that would keep people from making the same mistakes. Teach them that they were merely a part of nature, not the masters of it. Now more than ever before, ignorance was the enemy. Knowledge could keep them from winding up like the Anasazi, with nothing but ghosts inhabiting the ruins of a once great civilization. But since he had arrived at Project Headquarters in New York, Dev had experienced nothing but concern about how that knowledge was being used. The program now running in his personal computer both fascinated and frightened him, and he wondered what Higgins would say if he knew he had it. As Steele's therapist, Dev Cooper had been frustrated ever since he arrived in New York to take over from the late Dr. Susan Carmody. It was his job to conduct an ongoing evaluation of the state of Steele's cybernetic personality, and he had nothing to go on but his own best instincts. The science of psycho-cybernetics was in its infancy, and there existed no body of work to guide him. There had never been a man with a cybernetic brain, and Dev was faced with trying to find his own way, like a blind man groping in the darkness, trying to integrate what he knew of human psychotherapy with the science of cybernetics. And with Steele out working for Higgins much of the time as part of an ongoing project, R&D, Dev's time with him was limited. He made a point of getting close to Dr. Philip Gates and Dr. Julie Nakamura and other members of the Project Steele team, especially those who had been involved in the programming of his electronic brain. He pestered them with endless questions, risking their annoyance, desperate to find out as much as he could about his unusual and somewhat recalcitrant patient. He wished he could spend 24 hours a day with Steele, and it still would not have been enough. As things stood, there simply wasn't enough time to conduct a proper scientific study under such conditions. He had mentioned this to Gates while they were having lunch, voicing his frustration, not really expecting Gates to hand him a solution, but to his surprise, that's exactly what Gates did. Gates sat there holding his pipe in his mouth, and he had grunted, which was his way of acknowledging a statement, that he had considered what Dev had said not as a simple expression of frustration, but as a problem that he'd been asked to solve. He thought about it for a moment, then nodded several times and said,
"Well, if you need to spend more time with Steele, and Steele is not available as often as you'd like, I can let you have the next best thing. I'll simply run a backup copy of its program for you."
David stared at him, not certain he had heard correctly. "A copy of his program?" he had said. "His mental engrams, you mean?" Gates had shrugged.
"Why not? You're his therapist, after all. It's really nothing but software. I don't see why you can't have a copy. All you need to do is load it into your PC and conduct your sessions with the program. It would just be the same as having Steele there, since his brain was programmed with the exact same data. The only difference is that he wouldn't be there in person, but I don't see where that would matter, really. In fact, it would probably be much more convenient. With the program booted up, you could either enter your questions into your PC or hook up a voice synthesizer peripheral just to talk to it."
"And it would answer? Just like Steele, I mean?" asked Dev, amazed.
"Well, it might not sound like him, but if you really wanted to, I suppose we could program the synthesizer to duplicate his voice. It's no big deal, although I don't see why that would be necessary. If it's just information that you want, what difference does it make what the program sounds like?"
"Well, I suppose it could make a difference," Dev had said, still slightly overwhelmed by the idea. "A therapist can often tell a great deal by a patient's speech mannerisms, the inflection of the voice, and so on."
Gates had shrugged. "Okay. So we'll program it to sound like Steele. That's no problem."
"But would it be the same?"
"Why shouldn't it be the same?" asked Gates. "It's Steele's program. I don't know. I wrote it myself. With some help from the team, of course. The program is essentially his identity, his personality, downloaded from his brain and augmented with some ancillary data. It's the same thing we use to reprogram him if anything happened to cause such a loss of data, such as an injury to the brain or a glitch of some sort. It's an exact duplicate of the program he's running on right now, so it'll respond exactly as you would respond. It should solve your problem. If you like, I could run a copy off of you right now. You could use it in your office or take it with you to work from home. That way, you wouldn't even have to need Steele there. In effect, you could boot him up and talk to him anytime you'd like."
"But would I be allowed to take the program home with me?" asked Dev, still a bit taken aback by Gates' casual attitude about the whole thing. Higgins said that he didn't want to classify material leaving the premises.
"They search you when you leave?"
asked Gates.
No, but... So who's to know? It's not as if you're going to sell it to some foreign power or something. What would they do with it in any case? It's just a program. I wouldn't tell them about anything about the hardware. Look, don't worry about it. I take classified material at home all the time. And most of the time, it's pretty innocuous stuff. Hell, they classify the toilet paper in this place as if it occurred to them. CIA, you know. You learn to work around them, otherwise you'd never get any damn thing done." He had gone with Gates back to his office, where Gates pulled up a backup copy out of his safe and ran off a copy for him, as casually as a computer hacker sharing protected software with a friend. And it occurred to Dev that Gates, with a typical engineer's mentality, saw things in a purely analytical, technical terms. He didn't really think of Steel as anything more than just another AI program that he wrote. In fact, those had been the very words he'd used, where he himself had been primarily concerned with reinforcing Steel's conception of his own humanity. To Gates, Steel was nothing more than a machine. Hardware, as he put it. Animated only by the software he was programmed with. Never mind that the software was actually Steel's human personality, downloaded from his organic brain. Gates didn't think of it that way. The way he saw it, he had taken some raw data, organized it, debugged it with ancillary data, and assembled it into the program that animated Steel. That Steel ran on, as he had said. To him, it wasn't a human personality that had been transferred into a cybernetic brain. It was a program that he had written, as if he had created it from scratch. He simply didn't think of it any other way. David waited in his office as Gates went out and brought back a VS peripheral, and then he'd watch as Gates programmed the synthesizer to respond in Steele's voice, working from the data that he had on file. He made the final adjustments, locked them in, boxed up the peripheral, and handed it to Dev, along with a copy of the program. "Just slip those into your briefcase when you leave tonight," he said with a wink. "They probably won't check. But even if they do, just tell them it's a new VS peripheral I checked out for you for your home PC as a test program to make sure it runs okay. They don't know any better. And if they have any questions, you can just have them check with me. Given your clearance, they probably won't even bother." And they hadn't. Dev had left the building with the backup copy of Steele's program in his briefcase, half expecting to be stopped, feeling the nervous anxiety of a young boy shoplifting for the first time. But no one had stopped him, and he had hurried home to hook up the VS peripheral and load the program onto his home computer, on loan from the project. Once that was done, it took him close to an hour to work up the courage to boot it up. He couldn't shake the feeling that he was doing something wrong. And technically, he was. He had taken classified data from the project lab without the official authorization. For the first time in his life, he had committed a crime. But it wasn't that which bothered him so much as the fact of what he was about to do. He was about to bring a duplicate of Steel online in his computer to interact with an electronic clone of Steel's human personality. It seemed incredible, but certainly no more incredible than the idea of a man with a computer brain. It was almost a foregone conclusion ever since the first implantable brain electrode had been designed back in the late 20th century, enabling the first primitive experiments with data and pictures to be transmitted directly to the brain with a tiny chip that interlaced with brain nerve endings. The development of the nanoprocessor followed, 1,000 more times more powerful than microprocessors, enabling the manufacture of wristband computers that could plug into a keyboard, screen, other peripherals, and larger systems. Then the Pico processor came online, 1 million times more powerful, constructed of molecule-sized circuits patterned on DNA and grown in a petri dish. The technology was there, the research in brains communicating with computers fully underway when it was interrupted by the war, and Project Download had picked up where they left off. Only the lack of proper surgical techniques and the accompanying political implications had prevented the implantation of the first artificial brain. Sophisticated artificial intelligence units with programs capable of duplicating the characteristics of human intelligence already existed at the close of the 20th century. The only real obstacle to computers truly capable of duplicating human reasoning was not the sophistication of the technology so much as the lack of knowledge concerning human perception, which led AI scientists... This says A1 scientists, I'm just realizing. Which led A1 scientists into the science of the study of cognitive psychology? Sure. The beginnings of what was to become the new scientific field of psycho-cybernetics. No one had doubted that the day would come when the first artificial brain would be implanted in a human being, but in the research of the scientific and technological aspects of the problem, the philosophical aspects of it had received short shrift. Could a man with a computer for a brain still be considered human, even if the data the artificial brain contained was transcribed from his own human mental engrams? Could a machine possess a soul? And if that human data backup could be transcribed into software, then would backup copies of that software become human clones, processing all the attributes of humanity except a body made of flesh and blood? As Dev sat at his computer drinking endless cups of coffee and almost trembling with anticipation, with anxiety, with both fear and fascination, he wondered if Philip Gates had fully realized the implications of what he'd done in giving him a copy of Steele's program. To Gates, locked in his engineer's mentality, it was no more than software. To Dev Cooper, it was the essence of a human being that he was about to boot up on his computer. An electronic clone, a program with, could it be possible, a soul. And he could not escape the feeling that what he was about to do was wrong, somehow obscene. Nor could he resist it either. He felt like Dr. Frankenstein.
It's alive. It's alive. He felt himself on the threshold of the unknown, of one of life's great mysteries. How could Gates have so casually given him the opportunity to do such a momentous thing? Because amazingly, he did not consider it as a momentous thing, but just another program he could work with. No more, no less. Only how would Steele respond if he knew that what he was about to do? Deb didn't dare tell him. If something went wrong here, he told himself, it was better that it went wrong with just a backup copy instead of Steele himself. That made it safer for his patient. Conducting therapy this way could revolutionize the science of psychiatry. Therapists would be able to use brain-computer interface to make copies of their patients' mental engrams and work with them, free of the anxiety of making a mistake, able to tell in advance how a patient would respond to treatment based on how the program would respond. Only, if the copy was the same thing as the patient, was it, in fact, no more than a copy? Only software? Or was it a patient in itself, possessing the same human vulnerability as the brain it transcribed from? Dev felt himself on the threshold of a dramatic new step in the field of psychotherapy, and at the same time, on the edge of an abyss. Gates had no comprehension of what he had done to him. Dev Cooper was afraid. He was afraid to do it, and he was afraid not to. Dev didn't smoke, but earlier that evening, he had gone out and bought a pack of cigarettes. He would have brought a bottle, too, but he was afraid to take a drink. He needed to be completely sober for this. He swallowed hard and started his tape recorder. Then, after staring at it for a moment, he switched it off again, realizing, belatedly, that he didn't really need it. He could simply save the session. Jesus, he thought, this really is incredible. He wondered how the program would respond. He wondered what he'd say to it. Only one way to find out. He lit up a cigarette, inhaled, coughed, took a deep breath, and booted up the program. A second passed. A second that seemed like an eternity. And then Steele's voice came from the speaker. It said,
"Where am I?"
End of chapter.